You know what you're going to. Anybody knows the inner eye lies what you're going through. Figure out that, let it out. Feel like the vibe so alive. You ride to the other side. And you cry as a lesson and a lesson in disguise. The vibe and the time of the inner eye. Cause I meet Shell and Hera and share it with the last five faces. And that is cast in the dark. It's sparkling off like a car. Ignition on a vision. Got a vision for the people. We all equal. Down for the cause of a fall. In the awe of the devilish claw. Hold out. When it out. Baby, that you know what I'm talking about. Cause soon as the beginning did you work to be winners as they linger in the body. And the absolute.
Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger, heard every Tuesday here on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. On today's show, you will hear two women activists speaking on the topic, Simone de Beauvoir, Prostitution and the Freedom of Others. Darlene Riga has a PhD, is of Ojibwe descent, and is a member of the Aboriginal Women's Action Network. Fazila Jiwa is a teacher and volunteer with Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. They were speaking at a conference called Remember Me, organized by Rape Relief and Women's Shelter on December 6, 2008, organized in memory of the 14 women massacred at the École Polytechnique in Montreal on that date in 1989. Darlene Rigo is the first speaker.
First of all, I'd like to clarify that I'm not so much a Beauvoir expert as a Simone nerd, wearing my Simone shirt today, and that our relationship is based more on long acquaintanceship than my current professional status. She and I go way back to my undergraduate years after her death in 1986, when I first learned of the second sex, and I might add, just strangely, just before the Montreal massacre. I wasn't formally introduced to Beauvoir since no one mentioned her in the philosophy classes I took back then at the University of Toronto, but I sought her out based on hearsay. I was rumored in non-mainstream writings I had begun to read on my own that she was a famous feminist, and our relationship began on a rather suspicious footing. Reading Jean-Paul Sartre's account of slimy holes and the obscenity of the feminine sex as everything which gapes open, a threat to the supreme masculine subject, even if degraded and emptied, left me wondering just kind of a woman would keep such questionable company. Studying Beauvoir's work for many years after that first introduction, I think I've come closer to an answer. She was a complicated woman and thinker who questioned who she was in relation to the guarded privilege of masculine subjectivity in her time. Today, I continue to appreciate her philosophical challenge to models of subjectivity premised on egoism, separation, and domination, in large part because I find that they're still with us. When Lee Lakeman, on behalf of the organizers of Flesh Mapping, first asked me if I'd be willing to talk about the second sex and prostitution, I was a little nervous about it because I hadn't made any professional use of the material for my dissertation in a number of years, even though my thinking had continued to be shaped by it, particularly on the topic of prostitution. Nevertheless, I'm glad to have the opportunity here to share my old rusty ideas and hope that you'll bear with me if I get too academic, read too much and bore you, or if I'm too hasty and gloss over or oversimplify important ideas. Hopefully there will be time at the end for questions. What I want to try to do today is convey the main lines of my thinking on the second sex and its treatment of prostitution that addresses why I think the issue is important and one that affects us all. Since my interpretation is not a conventional one, this may require some broad strokes. I will provide a bit of an introduction to the text in my reading of it, then discuss the chapter, Prostitutes and Heteras, and what I take to be the relevance of Beauvoir's treatment today. I will consider her concepts of freedom and transcendence and how, despite many feminist interpretations, they are not individualistic nor reducible to the substance of men's work. Authentic work and freedom for Beauvoir have to do with working toward the freedom of others, and freedom is not radical or voluntaristic, independent of life situation or limited to individual choice, but admits of degree, and in its fullest expression is more of an active communal ideal. It has to do with the individual's capacity to transcend herself toward others and create a better world for all. That is, to contribute to the project of universal freedom. In other words, it's not an individualist, liberal feminist, or Sartrean breed of freedom. And by saying that it's not Sartrean, I mean that it is distinct from Sartre's concept of radical freedom, outlined in Being and Nothingness of 1943. That's the same work that describes the slimy holes, and wherein it is the sole prerogative of the individual subject, posited as separate from and hostile to others. by saying that Beauvoir's concept of freedom is not liberal feminist, I mean to detach it from related readings of the second sex as an uneasy application of such an individualistic and masculine model that is featured in Sartre's work to the problem of women's oppression, with the implication that women should aspire to it. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the text and its history, so I'll provide a bit of background to help situate my interpretation of it. In my view, it is probably the most misunderstood work of comparable stature in the last century, and that's the last 100 years since Beauvoir was born. That was 1908. Since its controversial appearance in France in 1949 and the relatively popular reception of the abridged 1952 English translation, it has largely been ignored or discounted as a work of philosophy. I believe that the English translation is one of the reasons for this lack of philosophical appreciation, besides, of course, just plain old-fashioned sexism. It was undertaken by H.M. Parsley. He was a retired male professor of zoology, of all things, who knew little of philosophy and was given free rein to edit the text. Besides omitting about 10% of the original, there are extensive errors, misleading translations, and additions, which are often unbeknownst to the English reader, especially those unfamiliar with philosophy. And I was enough of a nerd to have read both versions side by side in order to track all the differences. Did an 8-year PhD as well. Among philosophers, most have regarded the book as a mere footnote to the work of Sartre, and the text has thus received its most scholarly readings from feminists who have generated a wide range of responses to it. From its Anglo-American recognition as a work of origin for the women's movement from the 60s and 70s to critical and dismissive accounts of its allegedly Sartrean framework and theoretical datedness in the 80s, a more balanced wave of criticism is evident in feminist readings since the 90s. There was a bit of a tidal wave of criticism just after the 50-year anniversary of the text, and as luck would have it, that was just as I was getting into my research. And most of the readings since then have argued that the text moves beyond Sartrean philosophy in many important respects. His rather dualistic ontology of the for itself and the in itself, roughly designating a radically free consciousness separate from a thingly mute matter and from others in relations of mastery, has provided the general framework for understanding Beauvoir's work, even operating as a bias against evidence to the contrary. It is generally believed that she builds upon or applies his theory to gender oppression, often leading her into all sorts of puzzling problems and glaring contradictions. But I maintain more radically that the second sex does not even begin with his individualistic philosophy, but is a work of phenomenology which owes a more substantial debt to other philosophers who describe our fundamental way of being in the world as being with others. I think it is more consistent with the work of Martin Heidegger and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and their ontologies of being with others and conceptions of freedom are well recognized as at odds with Sartre's. And that's not to say that Beauvoir wasn't influenced by Sartre's work. I mean, clearly she was, as well as Hegel and Marx. I'm just saying that it was most essentially consistent with these philosophers. So I guess I should say a little bit about what phenomenology means. This will help provide a context for how I understand what she says about prostitution. Phenomenology is foremost a method, having to do with the how of research rather than the what. The what part of phenomenology has to do with ontology, or the study of essences, and as such, it is a way of trying to disclose the essence or basic meaning of something, its whatness. It is a rigorous questioning and detailed description of a phenomenon in an attempt to find the generality or what remains true of it, even as you vary your perspective on it. It strives to bracket, put in parentheses, or suspend our faith in everyday common sense or conventional knowledge, and even takes a skeptical view of received ideas or statements of scientific fact. No matter how self-evident such ideas may seem, phenomenology regards them as limited and fallible, human in origin, with a history to be unveiled. It tries to return to our own awareness of what presents itself to us, whether they're things, facts, or theories, in order to assess their truth for ourselves. It is an ongoing interpretive enterprise which is never complete, and any essences or truths it claims to uncover remain forever provisional, partial, and open-ended. There's no fixed essences or ahistorical absolutes. Just as in the world that phenomenology reveals, there's no pure consciousness, nesses or wholly separate things, others or ideas, but an ambiguous interplay, and nothing is taken for granted. It tries to reawaken a radical spirit of doing philosophy, which is not just a reiteration of old theories, those written by the old dead white men, but serves to put them to the test by reference to concrete lived experience. On my reading, The Second Sex does this, attempting to provide a concrete analysis of woman, both questioning conventional and ancient ideas, and describing women's existence in the many experiential dimensions of their everyday lives. Following phenomenological method, Beauvoir examines what has come to be regarded as the essence of woman and explores as many perspectives as possible. Questioning prejudices throughout the text, she does not assume that woman is already known or admit the traditional notion that there is some fixed essence traceable to biology that can be determinately theorized. From the outset, she brackets the questions of woman's existence and ends up rejecting any single causal explanation for the figure in which women appear in Western European society. In the introduction to Book 1, Beauvoir formulates her guiding query in the following terms, quote, "If her functioning as a female is not enough to define woman, if we decline also to explain her through the eternal feminine, and if nevertheless we admit provisionally that women do exist, then we must face the question, what is a woman?" Consistent with a methodological turn to subjective awareness and the approach to phenomena, Beauvoir considers her subject in relation to her own consciousness of it. She reports that if she wishes to define herself, her first step must be to acknowledge that she is a woman. Unlike men, who presume to take refuge in an independent viewpoint which postures as neutral, objective, and universal, Beauvoir first recognizes that she has been defined by reference to man. However, woman's subjective viewpoint does not disqualify the validity of her contributions, but serves as the condition and measure of their truth. Upholding an objectivity which is not absolute nor premised upon a disengaged neutrality, Beauvoir states that women, quote, "know the feminine world more intimately than men because we have our roots in it. We grasp more immediately than do men what it means for a human being to be feminine, and we are more concerned with that knowledge." Questioning how a woman affects one's life, opportunities, and fate, Beauvoir claims that the book is less motivated by a demand for rights than an effort toward clarity and understanding. Foremost, it is not an ideological quest nor a theoretical tract, but an open-ended interrogative study. And you can sense a little bit of defensiveness on her part in that statement, and likely in anticipation of the controversy that she was probably quite certain the book would inspire. But it's true to the extent that the book starts with a question that overall remains unanswered. So she's stressing that. She intimates that those who would find the question of what it means to be a woman trivial or without significance are those who believe that woman's destiny is inevitably determined. Contesting this essentialist idea from the beginning, she launches Book 1, Facts and Myths, with a discussion of the light in which woman is viewed by biology before going on to explore other causal explanatory facts and myths from man's point of view. Then in Book 2, L'expérience vécue, the French title of which clearly indicates the phenomenological dimensions of her study, designating lived experience, Beauvoir considers the question from women's point of view. This structural organization is an important clue that the work is not a one-dimensional expression of Beauvoir's own perspective, but functions as a critical engagement with man's point of view. There's a subtle dialectic played out in the text, which is most clearly evident in the chapter on biology, which, maybe not surprisingly, is the one that most critics cite to show that she's contradicting herself, but you can see how she starts with the male perspective, old traditional one, and then challenges it and then moves on to another perspective. So it's kind of tricky to follow if you're just doing a cursory reading or taking quotations out of context, but that's what I've come to understand she's doing. I maintain that if one reads the work as a phenomenological attempt to question anew what it means to a woman, that it is rendered much more coherent, comprehensible, and much less obsolete. As I understand Beauvoir, she's revealing the limitations of views of woman's essence as defined by men and statically predetermined. Although such ideas may have conditioned women's experience and are an aspect of a loosely defined generality in women's lot, her account suggests that woman is really a becoming, an incomplete project whose possibilities remain undisclosed, in part because of limitations in their ability to define it for themselves. Her descriptions imply that women are free to some extent, even in experiences of their oppression by men, but that the full manifestation of their freedom lies not with becoming like men or simply becoming independent subjects, but in their full participation in the socio-cultural world and the project of realizing communal freedom. Likewise, the chapter on prostitutes reveals that there are degrees of freedom and that the situation of neither the prostitute nor the hetera is conducive to its development in the fullest sense. At worst, the life situation of common prostitutes, which we might liken to survival prostituted women, reduces them to a kind of slavery in which their basic freedom as individuals is stunted from the outset. At best, even in the lives of some heteros, affords them a certain autonomy, their situation tends to trap them in a stifling egoism, discouraging their commitment to the well-being of others or the creation of a better world for all. The chapter falls in Book 2 of The Second Sex, Lived Experience, which is a far better translation than Parsley's Woman's Life Today. The English translation lends support to the idea that the text is dated in its characterizations, merely a sociological account of how some women lived in France at mid-century, and has little but historical interest to contemporary readers. Yet if we read it as an engagement, a phenomenological one, with traditional ideas, it's apparent that Beauvoir challenges the male bias in some of the perspectives she outlines, rather than perpetually contradicts herself. Moreover, she herself never claims to put forth timeless, complete truths of woman. She questions historical viewpoints and myths by reference to lived experience of prostituted women. And in my view, her descriptions remain surprisingly relevant. The chapter begins with a historical perspective correlating prostitution with marriage. Man vows his wife to chastity, but unwilling to subject himself to this regime, he uses prostituted women to satisfy his immoderate lust. In this sense, prostitution appears as a byproduct and safeguard of traditional marriage, and the prostituted woman, the degraded counterpart to the elevated, respectable wife. Beauvoir states, quote, "The prostitute is a scapegoat. Man vents his turpitude upon her, and he rejects her. Whether she is put legally under police supervision or works illegally in the street, she is in any case treated as a pariah. It makes no difference, according to Beauvoir, whether prostitution is legal or not. The prostituted woman is stigmatized and regarded as a social outcast in either case. She refers to the proclamation among fathers of the church that sewers are necessary to guarantee the wholesomeness of palaces, a commonly held view that prostitution is a necessary evil, the unavoidable damnation of some to protect others and society as a whole." Beauvoir likens this rationale to that of American supporters of slavery who held that Southern whites, in being freed from all servile duties, could maintain the most democratic and refined relations among themselves. Beauvoir, however, makes clear that such a caste system that sacrifices some for the sake of others is no path to freedom, obviously not for the slaves or prostituted women, but also not for the wives or anyone else for that matter, as she'll go on to elaborate. The entire system is corrupt. The association with marriage is then made in economic terms, with both seen as dependent on men for their livelihood and oppressed by them. Traditionally, for both wife and prostituted woman, the sexual act is a service binding women to men who use them for their own ends. The only difference, according to one author, is the price and length of time the contract runs. The salient difference, as Beauvoir sees it, is the respect accorded the married woman, which serves as a check on her oppression. Beauvoir states that, quote, "So long as the prostitute is denied the rights of a person, she sums up all the forms of feminine slavery," unquote. She challenges a number of the prejudices that justify the degraded status of prostituted women, the belief that they are somehow fit for it, choose it because of some kind of inherent, hereditary, personal, or moral failure. She maintains that it is naive to wonder at the motives that drive women into prostitution and shifts her focus to the men who create the demand for it and the society in which it exists. She states, "It is pure hypocrisy to wonder at the supply that masculine demand stimulates. That is simply the action of an elementary and universal economic process." She highlights poverty as the greatest factor compelling women into prostitution and, quote, "condemns society in which this occupation is still one of those which seem least repellent to many women." It is often asked, why did she choose it? The question is rather, why has she not chosen it? Examining the lack of alternatives that push women into it, Beauvoir's account suggests that social conditions and economic reality, rather than individual proclivity, are the main determinants. Prostituted girls and women often begin as domestic servants, far from home, sliding from one kind of slavery into another. Beauvoir states, exploited, enslaved, treated as a thing rather than a person, the maid can look forward to no improvement in her lot. Sometimes she has to accept the attentions of the head of the family. From such domestic slavery and sexual subjection, she slips into a slavery that could not be more degrading and that she dreams will be happier. Others are abandoned or prostituted by their parents or enter prostitution because of illness or to support their children. The common factor of early induction into sexuality is featured in terms which liken it to rape and may very well be. Girls as young as 11, 12, and 13 are violated before puberty, with high numbers of teenagers undergoing what is deemed the trauma of defloration. Some of the perpetrators in one study Beauvoir cites are lawyers, an architect, a doctor, and a pharmacist. Others include older relatives and complete strangers. In the blunt words of a 14-year-old prostituted girl, quote, once a door has been broken open, it is hard to keep it shut, unquote. With a hint of sarcasm to my ear, Beauvoir claims that it is unclear what psychological effects such a brutal experience would have on these girls, quote, because it is not customary to psychoanalyze prostitutes. Beauvoir claims that studies from her own time come to almost the same conclusions as those from 1857, and one may well wonder how much has really changed today. The poverty, the youthfulness of the girls, as well as the means used to pimp and procure women into prostitution and keep them there, sound familiar. Whether lover or seductive stranger, vulnerable girls become ensnared by those offering them a better life, leading them away from their communities. Even if cases of white slavery are relatively rare, Beauvoir surmises, women are often kept in the business against their will. If first trapped by violence, false promises, and deceptive offers of work, prostituted women often become enchained and unable to free themselves. As she continues to fill in the lived experience of prostituted women, it is the role of men that appears most questionable. Though pimps may beat and control them, they protect these women from other men who would be happy to vent their sadism on them. Revealing the harsh treatment they experience not only by individual men, but groups of them, Beauvoir refers to the gilded fascist youth in Madrid in her era who would amuse themselves by throwing prostituted women into the river at night, as well as to French students who for a good time would take girls to the country and leave them there naked at night. It is not surprising, Beauvoir generally implies, that many prostituted women try to set up a counter-universe among themselves to restore their human dignity. Most of them, she relates, come to harbor a deep disgust and resentment of men.
You are listening to The Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Darlene Rigo, PhD in philosophy, is speaking on Simone de Beauvoir, Prostitution and the Freedom of Others. She gave this speech December 2008 at the Remember Me conference organized by Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. This speech is followed by a shorter one that she gave at another conference held earlier in the year on the topic decriminalization, colonization, and the normalization of sexual exploitation.
Like the women whose lives she depicts, Beauvoir is highly attuned to the hypocrisy of men who use prostitutes, especially those of rank and power, who posture as morally upright and sit in judgment of the women they exploit, yet are themselves guilty of the most despicable behavior and vices when shielded from the public eye. According to a number of the women who know them in the shadows or behind closed doors, the vast majority of such men have, quote, abnormal vices, vicious tastes, and indulge in so-called perversities. According to one woman's reckoning, over 50% are disgraceful pederasts. Seeing this usually hidden side of privileged men, many prostituted women also develop a deep class resentment of them. One woman, Anna, who is described as usually gentle, suffered from attacks of rage, especially toward officials, which brought her to a psychiatric clinic. I really like this story. She came to be seen by Helene Deutsch, one of Freud's early colleagues, rendering her an unusual yet very telling case of the psychoanalysis of a prostituted woman. Hating doctors and all respectable men, Anna is quoted as saying, quote, why not? Don't we know better than anyone that these men easily drop their masks of gentility, self-control, and importance and behave like beasts? She is diagnosed as mentally well-balanced, apart from this attitude, a perfectly sane, bad attitude, I might add, in which I think Beauvoir intends. Another young prostituted woman, Julia, was only kind and helpful to men she considered weak. The others she regarded as wicked beasts who deserved harsh treatment. Beauvoir concludes this first section of the chapter maintaining that it is not their moral or psychological situation that is hard for these women to bear, but their material conditions that is most often deplorable. Quote, common prostitution is a miserable occupation in which woman, exploited sexually and economically, subjected arbitrarily to the police, to a humiliating medical supervision, to the caprices of the customers, and doomed to microbes and disease, to misery, is truly abased to the level of a thing, unquote. She adds a footnote here which seems to suggest the uselessness of criminalizing women and to recommend abolition through improving social conditions, changing mores, and eliminating the demand. She states, evidently, the situation cannot be changed by negative and hypocritical measures. Two conditions are necessary if prostitution is to disappear. All women must be assured a decent living, and custom must put no obstacles in the way of freedom and love. Prostitution will be suppressed only when the needs to which it responds are suppressed. As you may have gathered, I think Beauvoir's descriptions and interpretations are still relevant. In the next section of the chapter, she describes the lived experience of the hetera, a higher class of prostitute than the common one, which she describes as women who treat not only their bodies, but their entire personalities as capital to be exploited. Although their material conditions are vastly superior to their less fortunate counterparts, and some of them, like their latest incarnation as movie stars, are not prostituted in the strict sense, they do not embody authentic freedom, according to Beauvoir. She describes in detail the kinds of freedom that such a woman may achieve as she makes money trying to raise her sexuality to an art, but in the end, she, like the men who revere her, serves as no ideal. Men are again shown to be hypocrites for presenting themselves as paragons of virtue while secretly indulging their sexual urges and objectifying sexuality. While they may outwardly uphold Platonic ideals of beauty and supposed appreciation of the female form, they are merely elevating their obscenity to art. Older gentlemen pretend to be connoisseurs as if contemplating pure ideas as they pore over photographs of the chaste nude or art poses, are entertained by burlesque shows, or peruse a parade of women in a brothel. But Beauvoir implies that they're just really dirty old men looking at pornography and naked women with lust. Moreover, the objects of their desire are not so much artists, though this may be the rare case, but women who use men to satisfy their narcissism and meet their own selfish ends. What they're seeking more than creating anything new for themselves or others is admiration and financial security, means. Beauvoir states that their attitude is very different from that of creators, quote, who transcending themselves in the work they produce, go beyond the given and make an appeal to others to a liberty which opens up the future. The hetera does not unveil the world. She opens up no avenue to human transcendence. On the contrary, she tries to captivate the world for her own profit. She does not repudiate that passive femininity which dedicates her to man. She endues it with a magical power that enables her to catch the men in the snare of her presence and batten off them. She engulfs them along with her in imminence. To clarify some of this language, transcendence for Beauvoir is the activity of assuming our immanence, comprising our given situation, including our embodiment, social condition, and past, and projecting our lives into a collective future. There is no concrete content to women's transcendence, and an authentically liberated woman may do the same kinds of work women traditionally do, provided that the work is directed to the sustenance and freedom of others. It is not so much that the work be chosen, which would render it authentic, according to Sartrean existentialism. What's important is not the kind of labor or activity, but how the individual assumes it, whether it is chosen or not, and to what end, whether it opens up or closes off the future for oneself and others. What she criticizes throughout the book is repetitive labor, done in isolation without any reference to the future, as a banal maintenance of the status quo and a one-ended end in itself. She even claims that the cook's effort, which is directed toward the sustenance and freedom of others, rather than the preservation of things, is transcended toward the future, and the bourgeois woman with servants who escapes domestic toil yet is committed to a materialistic, peaceful conservation of the past, rather than the conquest of the future, is far from superior to the laboring housewife. It is uncertain what impact women would have on the future if they became able to contribute authentically to its shaping, except that it would not simply be a mere imitation of the male-defined norm. Beauvoir describes most men's work as comparably restricting. The transcendent new woman she heralds as an equal and genuine other to man is not to be formed according to some neutral model from the replacement of traditional women's work by men's, simply to adopt a pre-given and prevailing male model with a specific content and without concern for molding a collective future would be imminent and inauthentic to Beauvoir. She insists that feeling uncomfortable in masculine garb, woman must cut her own new clothes through a collective evolution. In fact, the building of a collective future is precisely how she defines human transcendence. As I've suggested, she's often been criticized for upholding this liberal feminist position, which equates transcendence and freedom with men's work, or becoming like men. Yet if you read the chapter closely, like the rest of the work, that's really not the case. Note that in her description of the hetera that I described earlier as opening up no avenue of human transcendence, Beauvoir refers to the importance of making an appeal to others, to a liberty that opens up the future. And although it may seem that she goes on to portray a free being in the hetera, she actually suggests that the path she follows is a dead end. It leads to no creative future, any inclusive new vision of humanity, but to a stifled existence rooted in the given world, shaped by the past, and the banality of a narcissistic egoism. Taking advantage of her status as a sex object and dependency on men, the hetera becomes somewhat emancipated. Nevertheless, paradoxically, Beauvoir states, those women who exploit their femininity to the limit create for themselves a situation almost equivalent to that of a man. They come to be subjects. Not only do they make their own living like men, but free in behavior and conversation, they can attain to the rarest intellectual liberty. The hetera also avoids being possessed by a man in that, lending herself to many men, she belongs to none. This type of woman not only achieves economic autonomy, but this liberation can be effective also on the erotic level. She will not be taken since she's being paid. Beauvoir claims that the women in ancient Greece who had the most freedom were neither matrons nor common prostitutes, but the heteras. She even maintains that the courtesans of the Renaissance and geishas of Japan enjoyed far greater liberty than other women in their times. However, suggesting that there's a more developed kind of freedom that is positively bound up with others, but which the hetera can only pretend to aspire to, Beauvoir states, her greatest misfortune is not only that her independence is the deceptive obverse of a thousand dependencies, but also that this liberty itself is negative. She creates nothing new. To her, the supreme value is her subjective success. She also justifies this individualism by a nihilism that is more or less reasoned, in that she is hostile to men and views other women as enemies. If she is sufficiently intelligent to feel the need for moral justification, she will have recourse to a more or less fully assimilated Nietzscheism. She will assert the rights of the superior being over the ordinary. So much so that, in being devoted to herself, she'll claim to serve the collectivity. It is precisely her individual freedom and success, a self-satisfied contentment with her circumscribed universe, which keeps the hetera from a more authentic manifestation of transcendence and freedom. Beauvoir claims that she, like the starlet, is dependent on public opinion, and the prostitute who simply yields her body may be even less of a slave than one who makes her career out of pleasing the public. The hetera is truly a kept woman who becomes held hostage by her individual success. She is too proud of having succeeded in making her place in the world as it stands to want things changed. Her struggle to arrive does not dispose her to embrace the concepts of fraternity and human solidarity. She has paid for her success by too much slavish compliance to wish sincerely for universal liberty. This chapter, like the second sex as a whole, suggests that freedom, though it requires that basic material conditions be met to come to fruition, is still more than a certain independence from others, financial self-sufficiency, or intellectual development. Although these may be necessary achievements for women who have historically been deprived of them, they are incomplete goals, merely checkpoints along the way to authentic freedom. As an ideal based on our being with others in equality, it is distinct from subjective or individualistic freedom, and it is clear that the men that Beauvoir describes by no means reflect its achievement. Authenticity has to do with mutually recognizing and promoting the freedom of others as an aspect of our own freedom. For Beauvoir, the problem with prostitution is not simply that it may or may not be chosen, as it might be in liberal or Sartrean terms, but that even when it affords a certain freedom for some women, it is rooted in injustice and inequality and fosters egoism in both men and women. It is basically at odds with authentic freedom and the end of liberty for all. If we are to become truly free individuals, it is our responsibility to cultivate the freedom of others, and it does not admit of the use of others as objects or means to one's own selfish ends, but we must support them as free beings. Beauvoir suggests that there could be no such freedom in a society that doesn't even guarantee the more basic kinds of freedom for all its members. It must first appear as a possibility, and material conditions may preclude it at almost every level. But since freedom is the essence of what it means to be both a woman and a human being, and freedom is grounded in our fundamental being with others, it's our job to try and establish the reign of liberty among all of us.
Yes, my name is Darlene Rigo, and I'm of Ojibwe descent, originally from Ontario. My PhD is in philosophy. So I just wanted to say about my interest in the issue of prostitution, that largely stems from my attempt to understand the life and conditions of my maternal grandmother, who raised me. I found out that she had been a prostituted Aboriginal woman when she was young and her children were hungry, and I've spent a lot of time trying to imagine, you know, what her life might have been like and comparing it to the conditions today and, you know, coming to terms with that and how I think, what I think would be better, you know, for Aboriginal women than the conditions that prevail now, particularly here in Vancouver, where I'm located now. And we found, getting together as members of AWON, that in sharing our life experiences, that prostitution touches the life of all of us in various ways, and we want to challenge the idea that legalizing it, even in an indoor form, is what Aboriginal women want, and to bring different voices to the debates, particularly to answer some of those that have been the most prevalent in the media advocating them. Overall, I want to argue that legalizing prostitution in Canada as a harm reduction measure in the form of a co-op brothel here in Vancouver will not make it safer for prostituted women, but in effect will legitimate their exploitation and increase the harm to them. In my view, it would set a dangerous precedent for the erosion of women's human rights and stand as a black mark on our international reputation as Canadian citizens. That is why I think it's important to not accept the idea that it's simply a matter of individual choice, but that it has far-reaching implications for how we conceive of the value of the individual within a greater collective whole. Despite attempts to characterize prostitution as simply a form of work, I think it's better characterized as a form of violence and a product of inequality, which is inherently unsafe. As Sherry referred to, homicide is a frequent cause of death among prostituted women. Entry into it is typically preceded by prolonged trauma, with most women or girls starting in adolescence. That's a really conservative statement. There's lots of studies that provide a range in early teen years. And prostituted women in Vancouver reported a 73% incidence of sexual abuse as children, and among those in the downtown east side, 82% reported a history of it by a shocking average of 4 perpetrators. In fact, this early experience of male violence among prostituted girls and women is a normal aspect of prostitution, which is characterized by common experiences of physical abuse and rape. From a study of 854 prostituted women in 9 countries of varying cultures, from Canada, Colombia, Germany, Mexico, South Africa, Thailand, Turkey, the United States, and Zambia, it was found that 71% experienced physical assault and 62% rape. From interviews of 100 prostituted women in the downtown east side of Vancouver, over half of whom were Aboriginal, 90% had been physically assaulted in prostitution and 78% raped. There is a continuum of violence from child sexual abuse, sexual harassment, verbal abuse, stalking, rape, battery, and torture, which occur regularly in prostitution. Do we want to condone these realities as occupational hazards or as the human rights abuses they are? Such practices are not only routine, but sexual harassment, if you think about it, is an essential component of prostitution. In a more extreme light, it may even be regarded as paid rape involving varying degrees of violence. As one woman in the downtown east side study put it, quote, "What rape is to others is normal to us," unquote. Rather than legalizing it, we would do better to legally recognize it as a form of violence against women. To conceive of it as a chosen form of legitimate work is a distortion and denial of this reality. It raises very problematic questions of consent, given that so many girls become entrenched in it well before the age of consent. And what keeps them there is not so much free choices as limited options, narrowed down by cycles of abuse, poverty, addiction, and unavailable avenues of escape. If it's indeed the interests and needs of prostituted women that are at issue, as pro-legalization debates suggest, then legalization is not the answer. Worldwide, it was found that 89% wished to exit, while in the downtown east side, the figure is 95%. What is required, based on these women's own understanding of their needs, are exit services, adequate housing, job training, and treatment for drug and alcohol addiction. In fact, legalized brothels would not benefit the most vulnerable street prostitutes. Most have substance abuse and serious health problems, which would disqualify them from entry. As is the case with existing legal brothels around the world, the women would have less choice about their customers, availability, rates, and acts performed, and be forced to comply with brothel regulations at risk of their jobs. Moreover, many would not choose the loss of anonymity required, which would stay with them for the rest of their lives. Although one of the reasons put forth for legalization is removing the stigma attached to prostitution, it would merely institutionalize it, in my view. In the case of Aboriginal prostituted women, there would also likely be an increased risk of losing their children to foster care as a result of exposing their undeniably high-risk lifestyle. There's also the danger that if prostitution became a job, women seeking social assistance might be directed to the sex industry and threatened with a denial of benefits if they refuse to consider some form of prostitution. There have been reports of this in Germany, where it is legal. Moreover, a study of legalized brothels in Nevada found that 80% would exit if they could. Legalizing prostitution doesn't regulate it in the interests of prostituted women, but expands it in the interests of johns, pimps, and traffickers who become legitimate entrepreneurs. Prostitution, both legal and illegal, increased in the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and Australia. And the greatest expansion was to illegal prostitution, which proliferated dramatically alongside the legal forms. What promoters of legalization don't say is that it promotes the trafficking of women and children, both locally from rural setting and reserve to city, and globally. The markets only multiply, moving ever poorer women from other parts of the country and world to richer, to meet an ever-increasing demand fueled by pornography and an increasing normalization of prostitution. We need to look at the demand for prostitution, the bigger picture that you don't see in the media. The role of men is usually rendered invisible, and the demand for prostitution taken for granted, as if it will be forever with us, reified as a given natural reality, with no attention to the flagrant inequality involved or the historical development of the multi-billion dollar sex industry. There's a limited focus on women, their individual choices, and arguable right to work as prostitutes. A harm reduction model that claims to help prostituted women by moving them indoors to legal brothels not only wouldn't reduce the harm to them, but disguises the real issues and really only benefits men. There is no evidence that I'm aware of that indoor prostitution is safer for the women involved, but just as violent and traumatic. Those promoting it rarely address class, race, or ethnicity as factors which make women even more vulnerable. And there may even be a class bias behind the belief that street prostitution is far worse than indoor forms. It is not really the street that's the source of the problem, but prostitution itself, which depends on a subclass of women. The history of prostitution in Canada suggests that it isn't the oldest profession, as it is often called, but the oldest oppression, with Aboriginal women serving as that exploited class, bought and traded for by colonists, if not abducted and enslaved by them. A major factor contributing to the missing women in Vancouver, many of whom are Aboriginal, was the lack of police response and the belief that the women were not worthy of protection. If we want to protect the most vulnerable women, like Picton's victims, we could start by decriminalizing them, not the men who harm them. It is common knowledge that women don't go to the police after so-called bad dates because they don't expect help from them, but further mistreatment. But it is my view and that of AWON that women should not be punished for their own exploitation. It is the men who will benefit from legalization, not women. The same lack of police response would prevail, particularly in that brothel operators would not be inclined to even call them. Imagine the concern to render a co-op brothel a success story and the potential bad press from publicized incidents of violence. Johns would have no fear of legal repercussions from buying women, and as in many legal brothels around the world, would likely be reassured that those made available up to them were free of STI and HIV. Given that the use of condoms is one of the most frequent sources of disagreements women on the street are confronted with, often leading to extreme violence, Would it be any better if the men were assured of their own protection from infection? And if prostitution were legal, there would be even less hope of escape for women. There wouldn't be much of a rationale for exit services, and prostituted women, having lost their anonymity, would experience even less social mobility. Although many well-meaning people think that decriminalization means protecting prostituted women from arrest, it also refers to the decriminalization of johns and pimps. If we want to help the women, we need to stop condoning practices that contribute to their ongoing harm and start addressing their real needs. If we want to make them safe, we need to get them out of prostitution and off the streets, really and altogether. Though you won't hear much about it in our local newspapers, the Swedish model of dealing with prostitution provides an example we should seriously consider. As Sherry described, it criminalizes only the buying of sex, not the selling, targeting the customer, pimp, procurer, and trafficker rather than the prostituted woman, and provides an array of social services to aid women to escape prostitution. Here in Canada, if we were to benefit those most in need, young Aboriginal women, it would help to think in more depth and long-term to focus on healing and prevention. I've argued that what is needed is not harm reduction, a short-sighted palliative measure which would amount to harm extension and expansion, but better, broader solutions in the interests of harm elimination. In Canada, we can do much more in the name and interests of human rights. Thanks.
You have just heard two speeches by Darlene Rigo speaking about the issue of prostitution. The first speech was entitled Simone de Beauvoir, Prostitution and the Freedom of Others. You will now hear Fazila Jiwa, teacher and volunteer with Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, speaking to the paper presented by Darlene Rigo. They were participating in a conference entitled Remember Me on December 6, 2008. This is the Local Brown Bagger on CFRL Radio 102.7 FM.
I wanted to explore further the difference between the two concepts of freedom that Darlene described. So one is the individual freedom, which is more liberal in its conception, and what we're all used to as our governments operate with this definition. Liberal in terms of the system and philosophy that our state has been based on. The other type of freedom is the universal freedom, or as Beauvoir names it, the freedom of others, in which true freedom is not achieved unless all are free. In my experience, individual freedom is encouraged to be our norm. The average person that I know will consider themselves free if they have a bit of an education, a place to live, and are able to comfortably raise their families. This definition, then, largely entails being economically comfortable, which I believe is only one aspect of authentic freedom. The flaw in this liberal definition is that it's too individualistic. It focuses only on the freedom of one person and perhaps a few others that are close to him or her. We can call ourselves free in this definition, despite the fact that hundreds of people are destitute in this extremely wealthy city. Beauvoir's concept of freedom is inclusive not only of a collective, but I believe that it addresses human rights rather than remaining a purely economic measurement. Freedom has not truly been achieved unless all people are not only economically able to survive, but also equal in rights and dignity. Feminists have taken on the idea of collective freedom with the slogan that decorates the walls of Rape Relief's Transition House, "No woman is free until all women are free." I bring up this slogan because I want to highlight why it's important to make a distinction between individual freedom and the freedom of others when discussing feminism and, in particular, prostitution. The existence and acceptance of prostitution as a trade, defining it as a legitimate work and not the oppression of the freedom of some for the gain of others, accepts that as a society, we're okay with delegating an entire class of women to the purpose of serving the sexual needs of men. While this is acceptable, no woman is free, according to the feminist slogan, and no person is free, according to Beauvoir's definition of authentic freedom. Through my experiences, and through Rape Relief's collective experience of 35 years of working with prostituted women, I learned the reality of the conditions of prostitution the overwhelming majority of women in prostitution have no choice at all. Prostitution is an oppression that is forced on them. It's sexist because the majority of people targeted for prostitution and currently in prostitution are women and girls. It's racist because of those women and girls in prostitution, the majority are women of color and Aboriginal women. In Vancouver especially, Asian women and Aboriginal women are grossly overrepresented in both indoor and outdoor prostitution. It's classist because the majority of women are forced to enter prostitution because they are poor and have no other means of survival for themselves and their families. The women trafficked into Canada for sexual purposes, I have seen in my experience, are mostly from poor Southeast Asian countries of the Pacific Rim or Aboriginal women who are trafficked from the northern areas of Canada. Trafficking is a major issue in prostitution and one that is constantly overlooked. Human trafficking happens for the purpose of cheap labor. That's always the phrase that's in the news and in government jargon. What's hidden in that phrase is the latent acceptance of prostitution as an industry, and thus it becomes part of the realm of trades that require cheap labor. Prostitution also involves the rape of children. The average age of entry into prostitution internationally is 14 years old. At this age, a woman is considered a child by most states and is thus unable to give consent, which then means that her work is to be raped several times a day. Even if we subtract all of these factors that name prostitution as oppression, it is still inherently violent. I think that prostitution is the misuse of a woman's body, and the very act of being entered over 20 times a day is painful and constitutes abuse. Some prostituted women use anesthetics just to get through the day. Thus, I learned that prostitution is not a choice that women make. It's not a choice because women in this situation have no alternatives aside from deciding between spending what little money the state affords them in the form of welfare on food so they don't starve or on shelter so they don't freeze. Or another choice that they may have is between being beaten severely by a pimp or a john that has bought them from a black market that they might have been forced into as children, or just doing it and medicating the pain of reality with drugs. Darlene mentioned the concept of the hetera, who is the woman who is paid well for prostitution and who men covet and who believes that she is free and has a choice. Darlene explained how the hetera does not have authentic freedom because she is still subject to the wills and the preferences of the public. And without that, she is just another oppressed woman used for sex. How can we achieve Beauvoir's ideal of freedom by freeing others when prostitution is a legitimate trade and is accepted by the public with a sigh of resignation that this is the world's oldest profession? In fact, it is the world's oldest oppression. So the legalization of prostitution then justifies and institutionalizes this oppression, and according to Beauvoir is inauthentic freedom. It entrenches the status quo, which is that some women are there to be sacrificed for the desires of men and does not fight for the end of this type of oppression. There are many problems with legalization, from the documented surge of unorganized crime and illegal brothels to the social justification that legalizing prostitution will destabilize the moral judgments made on prostituted women. But to me, making prostitution legal and acceptable ignores an inherent denial of human rights and freedoms for an entire half of the population to achieving real equality. Legalization is an expression of the individualistic concept of freedom. We can all go about our lives without having to see street prostitution because it occurs only in the red light districts of the city, where we believe that it's policed and under control. We do not realize that the freedom of other individuals is denied just by our complacency. Abolition is a word that came from the fight to end slavery. as Darlene mentioned. It says no to the liberal idea that prostitution is a reality that we have to live with. Instead of humming and hawing over the woman's choice or lack of choice to enter prostitution, abolition shifts the focus to the only clear choice that I can see, which is a man's choice to buy sex or not to buy sex. There is a latent myth in this world that men are lustful creatures that cannot control their sexual desire and urges. So if we did not have prostitutes for them to satiate their lust, maybe there would be an increase in rape. I don't believe that myth, and I think that the prolification of it encourages boys and men to think that they don't have a choice. Abolition is not a flat-out, insensitive no to prostitution. It criminalizes the John for choosing to buy sex, and it decriminalizes the women who have no choice but to enter prostitution. But the most important aspect of abolition is the infrastructure in the form of government support and services that first needs to be in place. The two most important parts of that infrastructure is a guaranteed livable income and exit services. So a guaranteed livable income is the idea that everyone has the right to survive in this world, but does anyone know how much the welfare rates are in Canada? For example, for a family of three, the amount is $1,054. So that is not enough to live for three people. And we end up needing to supplement our income in illegal ways because any legal income is deducted from your check. The second point is exit services. And by that I mean detox beds, counseling, training for new jobs, education, and housing for women who are seeking to escape from the Johns and pimps in the streets. I don't support a world in which strategies that make oppressive conditions a little bit better or a little bit safer are acceptable. I want the people in this room to know that we can fight for big goals and for an end to prostitution. Abolition is an expression of Beauvoir's authentic freedom, and the freedom of others is the route to truly being free. We can fight for the freedom of all, and we can make the choice to not tolerate the violence done to our sisters and mothers and daughters.
This is the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, BC. On today's Brown Bagger, you heard two women speaking on the topic of prostitution at the Remember Me conference in Vancouver on December 6, 2008, organized by Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. The speakers were Darlene Riga, PhD and activist with Aboriginal Women's Action Network, and Fazila Jiwa, teacher and volunteer with Rape Relief and Women's Shelter.
Real is now the reality. We'll go true and you tell me, do you know?
Real is now the reality.
Control.